Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. Text, phone number, same, 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Like us on Facebook. We are very close to 12,000 fans. Let's hit that peak. Like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And if you go to our Facebook page, it's constantly interactive and updated. You should always check it out. You will find all the information for my next guest, our regular guest. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. His name is Dan Feinberg. And you can follow him on Twitter at The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N, at The Fine Print, at Twitter and Facebook. Dan always joins us to talk television, and we welcome Dan to the show. Hello, Dan.
How are you doing, Nick?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Okay. I don't know if you saw last night's Broad City yet.
I have not seen it.
Okay. I won't ruin
it. I hear it's good. I hear it's really good.
Yeah. Well, it's consistent as good as, you know, because it's one of the funniest shows on TV. And I love those two women very much. But as you know, each episode has basically, you know, first of all, they're funny. They're great. They're beautifully written. They're very, very funny. But they also feature a pretty special cameo. I don't know if you know who the cameo was for tonight's episode.
I do not yet
okay,
know.
Good. All right. Well, I won't ruin it for you, but just needless to say, it's hysterical. It is hysterical. But I have to say,
they've done pretty good this year.
Oh yeah, they have. I mean, in one episode, they had Alan Alda as a magical chiropractor, Cynthia Nixon as the head of the local Hillary Clinton campaign office, and Hillary Clinton on one episode.
And Hillary Clinton was definitely the third funniest of those three people.
There's no question about it.
Rather comfortably.
Yeah. It was, you know, I kept thinking to myself, I just have a feeling that Chelsea said, Mom, just do this. Trust me. And you're like,
I don't know. She seems likely, but Hillary's always good about doing those things, about making those appearances and kind of making it look as if she's in on the joke,
right,
even if we all kind of have questions about how much she's in on it. And I kind of wanted her to do a little bit more on Broad City. I kind of was hoping for at least one yes queen out of her or something,
mm-hmm.
And it just didn't come. I thought maybe with the waving inflatable thing that Hillary was going to do her impression of the waving arm inflatable man.
Yeah.
Didn't do that. There were opportunities, I thought, for a little bit more humor out of Hillary. But, you know, she tried. She's a good sport.
I got to say, maybe my expectations were, because I knew that she was supposed to be on the show. You know, I mean, they made a big, I mean, obviously you're going to advertise the fact that a presidential candidate in the current election and who's making an appearance on your show, you're going to advertise that ahead of time. So it was no surprise. I knew she was going to show up on the show. But honestly, Dan, I expected them to have shot her stuff someplace else and to never had them in a two shot. I thought it would be like fake over the shoulder reaction shots. Honestly, I didn't expect them to have any kind of, you know, interaction at all. So on that level, I guess I was just surprised that she was even there.
They had posted pictures with her previously.
Oh, okay.
So I knew that at least at some point they occupied the same physical space at the same time, and so they might as well have had the cameras running at that particular moment. I thought it was okay, and she wasn't distractingly off-putting for me, and
right.
I don't suspect that for most of the Broad City audience she was off-putting. I don't think that's an audience that sees Hillary Clinton and goes, ooh, I think that's probably a pretty welcoming, embracing audience for her. So
I agree. I really thought, I mean, Alan Alda destroyed me on that episode. I mean, the haircut was one of the funniest sight gags I've seen all year.
It's been a good season. It's been a good season of really tight episodes. And as you say, lots of guest appearances. I wonder if they're turning anyone away. I wonder if there are people who are trying to glom onto this as kind of the hot place to go if you want to, you know, do, I don't know, 5 minutes of work, ten
yeah,
minutes of work,
sure,
and get nice exposure.
Yeah.
I assume probably there are some people who they say, yeah, you're just not. You're not Broad City material, kid.
Yeah. Well, Tony Danza is, which I was pleased about.
Tony Danza was a good sport, and you just sort of had to deal with the, do I buy Tony Danza as Jewish?
Yeah.
Sure, why not? I can accept that if I need to. I bought him as being sort of in this world, and again, was a good sport, and
yeah,
so And I kind of liked the stepping out of their comfort zone nature of that episode.
Oh, yeah.
Back to the hometown episode.
Oh, yeah. I love them in Philadelphia. It was just and you tweeted about Ilana making the strike.
I haven't gotten the story yet, and I feel like someone out there on the internet has to have written this story of how many takes that took, because it was glorious.
It was.
And we just want to believe, okay, she can just do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, until someone gives me the answer, I'm going to assume she did it in one take, and that's just one of those things that Ilana can do. But yeah. I wonder if the answer was like 75,
right?
If they were there all night and they were just having fun drinking beer at the bowling alley, whatever it was wonderful. Yeah. I rewound that several times.
Oh, it was just great stuff. We'll keep digging to find the truth, Dan.
At this point, I may have stopped. At this point, if people want to point me to the article where she says how long it took, I will have the illusion destroyed for me. If they don't want to, I will just keep it in my heart.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about NBC has set alive a Few Good Men performance. Now, some people might not know this, that it was indeed a play and a Broadway show before it became the movie with Tom Cruise and Demi Moore and Jack Nicholson and everybody else. And it was a very successful play for Aaron Sorkin. The decision to do it live, how do you feel about that?
I feel fine about it. I think it's everyone wants it. Everyone wants the live experiences because, you know, Grease Live was such a big sensation for Fox, and NBC had the huge hit with Sound of Music Live, and then had the big disappointment with Peter Pan Live, but then had another big hit with The Wiz last year. So everyone wants those live things because they get people tweeting, they get people talking, the advertisers like them, and doing a theatrical event instead of just doing yet another musical, I like it as a mix-up. They're still doing Hairspray in December, and I have honestly zero interest in that whatsoever. I think that Hairspray is an okay musical. I don't think it's a great musical. I don't think it's a musical they can add anything to, and I think that the movie version of it was relatively decent, and it was only 10 years ago, so why do they need to bother? I don't like that, but I would definitely tune into a well-cast version of, well, what am I talking about? I'll watch it regardless of how well cast it is, but I will happily watch a well cast A Few Good Men.
I'm with you 100% on Hairspray. I'm not sure why they chose that. And for me, when I watch Hairspray, I watch the movie from 1988. That's what I watch. I go back and I watch the original John Waters movie, which I love, and never quite understood why they made it into a musical, except that, you know, Waters got paid, which makes me happy.
And I think that in general, it's a amiable musical. I just think that they kind of got the impression that it has to be a musical that has current life for some reason. And I don't know that that was necessarily why The Wiz worked out as well as it did. I just think that Hairspray is something that was easy for them to throw together. I don't get it. It doesn't seem to be what their goal was with these live theatrical events, and I can't, you know, even if they get the best casting in the world for the main part, the John Travolta, Harvey Fierstein, for that part, I just still don't know what it's going to take to get me excited for it.
Yeah.
But maybe other people feel differently.
And A Few Good Men is set to when is it going to air? Is it
early 2017? They don't have a date, and they haven't gone over various different things. Like, for example, Aaron Sorkin will be involved. So the question is he going to update the script? Because certainly the location and the Guantanamo of it all, it means something different today than it did both when the play came out and when the movie came out. So is Aaron Sorkin going to put in a couple hours in final draft making edits and updating things for fun? They haven't said that, but he will be involved to some degree. And they've talked about this one for a couple of years, but the announcement that came today was sort of more definitive. It was, okay, it's going to happen in early 2017. I just think in order for it to work, they will have to have the right Jessup and the right Daniel Caffey, and so I'm looking forward to hearing.
Yeah. I actually really like this idea of live television coming back. Do you think that this is a trend that will that will spread out among different genres, not just plays and musicals, and besides Saturday Night Live, do you see like live TV coming back in any other way?
I think that if you look at the landscape, it's coming back in certain ways. Like NBC has Undateable Live, or had Undateable Live, that aired on Fridays all fall and is kind of in limbo now. And they liked the experiment of it. The ratings were not in any way there. The question with live TV is always the same thing, is are you going to get people to actually watch it live?
Right.
Because people won't watch it later because there's nothing to talk about later. But, you know, sports are still where it's at. Everyone wants sports because they're live. Everyone wants the right award shows because they're live and people talk about them. And so this is all just extending that. It's expanding it into as many corners as humanly possible. And I'm okay with it. It helps me prioritize the things on my DVR slate, and that's what their goal is. Their goal is, can we do something that will make you prioritize this over the other six things in the same time slot? And sure, go ahead. Make my decisions a little bit easier, TV.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, I think it's a nice trend. And it's interesting that NBC has really, in recent history, embraced it. I mean, with 30 Rock going live a couple times. I remember, was it 20 years ago that they did the ER live, which was such a huge thing.
And that was one of those things where Clooney was all excited about it, and he also was behind Failsafe Live.
Right.
I don't remember if that was NBC or if that was not NBC, but they did that, and it was less successful, and people don't really remember that that was a thing that happened. But if you go back and look, it was a live production, star-studded, all of that. NBC definitely is involved. Robert Greenblatt, who's the head of the network, has a background in New York City theatricals and all. This is to some degree his world, and he's figuring that event TV is a way of moving the needle. And, you know, so it didn't work on Smash. Smash wasn't a success, but the Dolly Parton thing they did in the fall, which wasn't an event in the same way, but it was still, you know, a pretty big hit.
Yeah.
And now, of course, the whole world is all in love with the little prancing, dancing little children and Steve Harvey on Sunday night. So, you know, there's no way of necessarily figuring what the next big thing is. But NBC is at least trying to push on eventizing stuff. And sometimes it seems to work and produce interesting things. And sometimes it produces things like the Dolly Parton movie. And I know that it just wasn't for me in the first place.
Right. Okay. All right, Dan, hang on. All right.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us, and he joins us regularly to talk TV. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. 312-981-7200 is our talk and text. And you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more television right after the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here. Live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We'll be here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and Steve Cochran at 6. He's back this morning. We're going to be talking about really bad and really hilarious pickup lines. And this is taking off from a story involving Selena Gomez, and we'll get into that in a little bit, and that'll be coming up later on. But right now we're talking TV. Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, at The Fine Print. And he's here to talk more TV. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
Okay. We can't discuss television if we don't talk about the loss that TV felt last week when Gary Shandling passed away, who was one of my comedic heroes and was responsible for two of the most original and groundbreaking television sitcoms in the history of the medium. And so, you know, the first question is, how did you find out? I'm assuming the internet or on your phone or whatever.
Absolutely everything these days comes only via Twitter and when TMZ wants you to know things. That's how we learn sad news, is when TMZ wants to tell us these days. So,
Obviously, you know, what he's left behind is extraordinary. And how would you look at his history in terms of his contributions to TV?
Well, I sort of look at him in different levels. The sort of the main level in which I remember him, honestly, is as being this, like, when I think of 80s stand-up comics who were for some reason constantly on in my childhood on the background in TVs, he's the guy I think of for some reason.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, his Showtime special in 1984 or 85, I must have seen chunks of that 1,000 times. So I associate him so heavily with that. And so Larry Sanders, I came to a little bit later. When I first watched it, when it first came on, I just, for some reason, didn't get it or wasn't amused, and then revisited it 10 years later and like, oh, okay, this is, you know, this is fantastic. This is the, one of the best casts ever assembled for a TV show. This is a writing staff of every single one of the people who went on to become great writers and to shape the comedy of the next 20 years from Judd Apatow on. Honestly, and this is a gap in my knowledge, It's Gary Shandling's Show is a show that is just not part of my perspective. Mm. And I know some people love it. Is it a show that's part of your...
Oh, yeah. Perspective? Without question, absolutely, and it seemed to me like with It's Gary Shandling's Show, he was already messing with the form of the sitcom and pushing it, and doing things that nobody else was doing. I mean, and it's, first of all, in my opinion, it's one of the greatest theme songs in television history. The Gary Shandling, and everything about that show felt fresh and unusual and new. And at that point, I was already on board with Shandling. And you're right; I mean, he was ubiquitous in the '80s in terms of like. People who stand in front of brick walls, you know, telling jokes. But he was great at it. He was one of the best stand-ups ever. His material, incredibly funny, fresh every time, and very few could deliver it in the voice that Gary Shandling so consistently delivered his comedy in. And so, yeah, It's Gary Shandling's Show was a big one. And it just seemed to me it was kind of a game changer. And then when Larry Sanders hit, I mean, it went beyond what It's Gary Shandling's Show did. But yeah, both of those shows were huge on my radar. Absolutely.
And I don't know why It's Gary Shandling's Show just hasn't, I guess, it just hasn't made it into circulation in our streaming, constantly recycling world.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a pity. But Larry Sanders really is a show that you can pick up today, and it feels the sense of humor and the sensibility is so modern, and it's so, and obviously that meant it was so far ahead of the curve at the time. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, you go back and you look at the writing staffs that were accumulated on these shows, and you look at It's Gary Shandling's Show, and you know, it had some people like Jeff Franklin, the Fuller House and Full House guru, but also Al Jean, Mike Reese, before they started doing The Simpsons.
Yep.
Sam Simon, I think, also worked on that one. And then Larry Sanders, it was just everybody, every writer who you think was influential or important went through that show at some point, from the people who were at the top of it, the masthead, the Paul Simmses and Peter Tolans, just right on down the line. They got brilliant people working.
No question about it. And you mentioned perfect casting, everybody in that show. Up until transgender, that was Jeffrey Tambor's quintessential role. There's no question about it. And I don't know if I've ever seen Rip Torn better than in anything than he was in that. But it was just, an amazing show. And going back after Shandling died, I went back and I started watching Sanders again. I think a lot of people did. Just to feel the need to have a little bit more Gary Shandling, because I couldn't believe he was dead. And I went back and I watched a lot of them. There was one episode in particular that I found kind of striking and really depressing. And the guests were Warren Zevon, John Ritter, and Gene Siskel. And it was exactly. And it was like, here, the four main people on stage at one time during this episode they all died way too young. And it was startling, and it really was just rewatching it. Those were the guest stars, and I don't know.
A lot of stuff like that, just going around the clips of him and, you know, sort of clips of him bantering with Rock Williams.
Yeah.
That makes you, of course, invariably depressed and saddened now.
And the coffee in the Comedians in Cars with Coffee, that episode that he did just a few weeks ago, where like the predominant subject matter of that episode was death. And it was very strange to watch. I had watched it, you know, a few weeks ago. Or a couple of months ago, whenever it first debuted, I watched it, and then I rewatched it again after his death, and we played a bunch of clips here on the show when we were paying tribute to Shandling last week. And some of the conversations that they had it was just a little creepy.
It's odd that it's creepier, given that by all reports he was in good health and there was nothing that anyone knew was coming. So this isn't like when David Bowie dropped the album. Yeah. And everyone thought, okay, this is a little bit sort of morbid and whatever, and then he died, and then suddenly everyone was like, oh my God, he knew he was going to die, and he wrote his last will and testament in album form.
Yeah.
You know, he knew this. Mm-hmm. Gary Shandling didn't apparently know this, and that makes it eerier.
Well, I encourage anybody, because, you know, you can see all the Larry Sanders episodes. They're all over the place. And if you've never seen the show, when you watch it, realize that this was over 20 years ago when this stuff aired. 25 years ago. And it's, as you said, Dan, massively ahead of its time. You know, the sensibility that was on that show, the single camera stuff, it influenced so much comedy that's on television right now, and even network television now, that, you know, you have to go back and watch it just to see the impact that that thing made in the world of comedy and television.
So. Absolutely.
Okay. There's a show that you did a review of that I wasn't really even aware of. I guess I'm not watching enough Netflix recently, because the last thing I watched on Netflix repeatedly was the Pee Wee Herman movie. Have we talked about that yet?
Which I haven't even gotten to. I think you mentioned that you liked it and that it was good, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. And one of these days.
Okay. You should. It's actually pretty great, Dan. It is actually pretty great. But I haven't really watched anything on Netflix. What is The Ranch? I'm looking at this. I cannot believe this cast. Tell everybody what The Ranch is. I am so curious about this.
The Ranch is a very strange series that Netflix is debuting on Friday, and it stars Ashton Kutcher and Danny Masterson. And Ashton Kutcher plays a former high school football star who sort of gigged around the country as a semi-pro player, but now returns to his family's ranch in Colorado. And Danny Masterson plays the brother who never left. And their father is played by, of all people, naturally, Sam Elliott. Their mother is played by, naturally, Deborah Winger.
See, that was it right there for me, Dan. It's like Sam Elliott, Deborah Winger. Okay. I am in.
It is very strange that these people decided to do a multi-cam comedy, but Netflix gets people to do things. And I'm sort of strangely protective of this show because everybody, you know, they put out trailers for it a week or two ago, and everyone's like, why is Netflix doing a conventional multi-cam show with Ashton Kutcher being shticky and, you know, the audience roaring and all of that? And I don't really think that's what the show is. It is a decent multi-cam comedy that also, because it has the Netflix running time, can go to 30 minutes. And because it can go to 30 minutes, it also takes 7 or 8 minutes every episode to be serious and to have really nice relationship moments. And so Sam Elliott is great and, like, just genuinely great here. And sometimes he's being great in a ha-ha-ha, I'm being a grouchy old man in a multi-cam comedy, laugh-at-me kind of way. But he also has these 5-minute-long scenes with Deborah Winger where they're just two people of a certain age talking about a multi-decade relationship that hasn't always gone the way they wanted it to, but you know, there's still a lot of love there, and they don't feel the responsibility to do set-up gag punchline, ha-ha-ha, everyone roars. Pull scenes play out. No one laughs once. And you just go, huh, okay, there are things that this is doing that it's doing very nicely. Ashton Kutcher, when he's being a sitcom guy, you know exactly what he is. But when he's being the kind of washed-up athlete who's disappointed his father, disappointed his brother, disappointed everybody, and sometimes he plays it straight, I think it's the best thing Ashton Kutcher's ever done. I think it's the most believably human thing he's ever done. And so you kind of have to catch these moments and treasure these moments when they're surrounded by a sitcom where some of the punchlines sound maybe a little bit familiar.
Sounds great to me. I'm so glad that you liked it, because as soon as I saw the cast, I just... Now, who's behind it creatively?
The creators are Jim Patterson and Don Rio. Don Rio has worked on literally everything. You know, he was a showrunner for a long time on Two and a Half Men, which is when he worked with Ashton Kutcher and all of that. But his, you know, he created Blossom, for heaven's sakes. He created the John Larroquette show. He created My Wife and Kids. His credits go all the way back to, like, MASH and Golden Girls. He's just this veteran sitcom guy who obviously had a sitcom in him that was something a little bit different. And, you know, it is Netflix content, so they swear. And that's a little bit strange when you hear it in a circumstance where the audience laughs, because you're trained to think of multi-cam comedies as being, I don't know, a little bit corners cut, censored, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, they're on network, and this is not that. It's an interesting kind of strangely experimental show that I think is really, really easy to judge and dismiss up front. But I watched 10 episodes of it, and I never felt as if it was annoying to be watching those 10 episodes. And I don't feel that way all that often with stuff that I watch when
there
are large piles of them.
That's great. Okay, that's great. You've sold me. Friday, it debuts this Friday, so it'll be tomorrow, April 1st, on Netflix. It's called The Ranch. All right, I'm in. Okay, Dan, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right. Dan Feinberg is with us. We're talking TV, and you can follow him on at The Fine Print. The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N, The Fine Print. And he's also the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And we'll talk more TV coming up right after we take a break right here on WGN. All right. Morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. Facebook, like us right now, facebook.com/Nick D Show. My guest is Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We love to talk TV, and we welcome Dan back to the show. Hey, Dan,
you
know, here's a question I have for you. So the last show that we were talking about before the break is a Netflix original called The Ranch. And I've never really thought about this before. Is it possible for these Netflix shows to go into syndication on broadcast television? Is that something that's been worked out? Because I know that some of the shows, you know, your HBO shows and your Showtime shows, which have that adult kind of content, those have all gone on to broadcast television syndication in edited form. Is that something that's been worked out with the streamlined stuff?
I would assume that it would be theoretically possible, but I don't think it goes with what the Netflix business model is, which is to have this library of content. And I think that when they produce things like this and they produce them in-house, they simply want them to be piling up and, you know, available forever and ever and ever. Amen. But on the other hand, you never would have thought when The Sopranos premiered that it would someday be on A&E, and of course the question of why exactly that had to occur and who exactly benefited from that, the answer being mostly nobody. So, you know, you never think about this being a thing that's possible until the revenue stream opens up and you go, okay, there's another stream, we might as well go down it. And so I don't think Netflix has ever considered that. On the other hand, if you look at sort of weird things where Netflix has this old for our original stuff, we're not, you know, it's not on DVD, it's streaming on Netflix, blah, blah, blah. But then House of Cards comes out on DVD and you can just buy it at your local Best Buy. And so there it is and it exists. But not every Netflix show comes out like that. And
it's
so it honestly is one of those things where they look and they go, okay, if there's an additional way to make money off of this, we'll find a way to do it. So far, there hasn't been that way for any of their shows to go and say, okay, now have a second run on ... That's just never been something that's been opened up. But the minute at which someone found a way to make money or save money by doing that, I bet you Netflix would experiment.
Yeah, I would imagine. Hey, speaking of Netflix, I did see the trailer for Ricky Gervais's new movie. Is it Special Correspondence?
Sounds right. Yep. I believe that's coming at the end of the month. I have not seen it, but I know it exists.
And I saw the trailer for it, and it looks very funny, and it's him and Eric Bana pretending to be in a war-torn area, but when they're actually in a hotel, faking the radio broadcasts. And Gervais wrote and directed it, so I guess that Gervais had a good experience with Derek and the people at Netflix.
And also, just this is what Netflix is trying to do, and they're trying it with all these different sorts of movies, and some of them... There was Beasts of No Nation kind of being an Oscar player, even if it ultimately wasn't an Oscar player. But, you know, it got awards attention. And allegedly that first Adam Sandler movie was successful in some way that no one would ever be able to measure, even though I hear it was one of the worst things ever produced for human.
I made it. You know how you have the little clock on the bottom of the screen there when you hit pause?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I made it through 41 minutes and 13 seconds.
Both true hero.
That's about how far I made it, yeah.
And then there's another one coming out in the early summer with Sandler and David Spade that they just released the first trailer for, and that looks horrible.
Oh,
and then But then also apparently Netflix is ponying up like $90 million for a David Ayer-directed Will Smith movie. So they're just trying everything, and they have more money than anybody else. So I guess the credit you give them is they could just do the exact same thing over and over again, and instead they do pretty much literally anything, and not bad.
Okay, interesting. All right, you have to tell me about this Winona Earp. Now, I watch some stuff on sci-fi. I watch a few things on sci-fi, namely Face Off. That's the my big go-to on the sci-fi channel. And I keep seeing commercials for this Winona Earp. And describe what this is, because it sounds completely ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, but people keep saying, oh, but what an awful title, because the joke is that she's the great-great-granddaughter of Wyatt Earp. And there's a Wyatt Earp family curse, and it involves the souls of all of the men who Wyatt Earp killed in his time as a lawman coming back in a small town called Purgatory. Kind of subtle that one is. And they come back as demons, and the only person who can stop them is one of Wyatt Earp's kinfolk, and only if they've got Wyatt's gun, Peacemaker. And in this particular case, the heir is Winona, and she's a attractive 27-year-old ne'er-do-well who ran from her destiny but now must embrace it. And it's, I described it in my review on The Hollywood Reporter, and many other people are as well, because it's a really obvious comparison. It's very Buffy the Vampire Slayer-ish, but kind of the early Buffy when it didn't know exactly what it was, but it still had original and fresh things about it that made you go, okay, if this ever finds what it wants to be, it's going to be one of the best shows ever. I don't know if I feel that way about Winona Earp, but if it ever finds out what it wants to be, it could be good. And that's not bad. It's, it's a kind of, it's an empowered heroine who kicks butt and shoots guns and quippy one-liners and all of that. And it's not bad. And, sci-fi has this long run of Canadian genre shows that they air and that obviously cost nothing at all to make, so sci-fi can just put them on and whatever. And if you haven't watched any of these shows, you aren't going to know anyone in the cast. And it's kind of striking to watch a show where you know so few people who appear on the screen. Mm-hmm. But they're all veteran Canadian actors, and if you happen to have watched Killjoys or Lost Girl or any of a dozen other Canadian shows, you might recognize them, but otherwise you might not. But instead, there's just some sort of fun action, some really silly mythology. And my reaction after watching two episodes was, I watch a lot of stuff that's worse than this. and this is more fun than a lot of stuff that I watch. It's not the most fun thing I watch. It's not one of the 50 most fun things I watch, but I definitely watch things that are less entertaining than Winona Earp.
That's a ringing endorsement, Dan.
Hey, it's slightly above average.
All right. I want to thank you before we take a break. We'll come back. But I want to thank you before we break, Dan, personally, for encouraging me to watch Carmichael's show. Because I really like it. I think it's really good. And I looked at your tweet and how like it's dropped and not a lot of people are as many people are watching it as they should. But I think it's a very good show.
And just keep telling people that's what I'm doing, and maybe the word gets around. It's really a significant show.
I agree.
It is a show that has merit.
I agree. I totally agree. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. We're going to take a quick break here for the news, and after the news, we'll jump back in, talk more TV with Dan Feinberg. 312-981-7200 is the talk and text line. He is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. All right, more TV talk after the news, which is next here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Hi. Nick DiGilio here on a Thursday morning. Yeah. And we'll be talking about really bad pickup lines and really bad pickup lines. That'll be coming up a little bit later on. It's also Triple Play Thursday. And if you want to pick an artist for the Triple Play Thursday, you know what to do. 312-981-7200. Right now, we're still talking with Dan Feinberg about television. He is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And we love to talk TV, and we welcome Dan back to the show. Hello, Dan.
How do you do?
All right. I have to say that I have, you had a TV critics debate about watching or stopping to watch or stop watching movies or shows. And I have to say that I did dump a show off my DVR. And I think I held on longer than most people did. But last Sunday night was my last vinyl.
Phew. I can't tell you you're wrong. I also can't tell you that I'm with you. I'm still going to keep recording, but
yeah, that last episode, you know, and I'll watch Bobby Cannavale do anything, but the stuff that they had him do on that last episode, and the height with which his, you know, cocaine binge, way over the top acting, and the other things that are happening in the show, I just was, okay, I said, you know, and I was a defender of that show, you know, like, people didn't even like the pilot. I know a lot of people didn't even like the pilot, and I love the pilot. And I was with it, and I was defending it until last week, and then I just went, okay, I'm done watching this.
I can't blame you at all. I just basically, the episodes, they record on Sunday night, and then I wait, and there's never a time that I want to watch it, and then finally I end up watching it, like, with my coffee on Sunday morning, because I know another episode is coming, and I don't want them to start piling up,
right.
Because once they pile up, that's definitely death.
Yeah.
But there's never a point at which I go, man, I am just right in the mood now to watch Bobby Cannavale snort coke and ineffectually attempt to bang underlings.
There's
just no point at which I go, that's what I want to watch right now. And for some reason, HBO thought that's the show that we want to do about the music scene in 1973. And I feel like that's probably the least interesting and the least entertaining approach they possibly could have taken.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm disappointed, you know, because there's so many talented people involved in it. I still enjoy watching Ray Romano in it, but not enough for me to go back, because I'm a big fan of Ray Romano. I was not. Here's the weird thing. I was never a big fan of Everybody Loves Raymond. It was fine. It was innocuous enough. I would watch it, a couple of laughs here and there. But Man of a Certain Age, I so much adored that show. And ever since then, I found him so interesting. I'm glad for him that he's got a part like the part that he has in Vinyl. It's just that it's just not very good.
It's very good that he's having this next level of his career where people are letting him do things that aren't just being Ray Romano sitcom guy.
Yeah.
So fantastic. And he does show more range each time. And that's terrific. I wish this show were better. And I was with you. I liked the pilot. I liked all of the Martin Scorsese touches. I liked the music. I liked those little musical interludes with the real people playing their music for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, or people playing the real people.
Right.
And no one subsequently has been able to use those even vaguely well. It's like this aesthetic quirk that people can't wait to get rid of. And that's sad, because Scorsese made it kind of work, and no one since really has.
You know, you know what would have kept me watching the show, despite how disappointed I was in Sunday's episode? If they could somehow miraculously bring Andrew Dice's character back to life. then I'd watch it.
and part of my weekend this weekend is dedicated to watching screeners of the
Dice
Fans upcoming Showtime show.
I can't wait to hear what you think of that. I cannot wait to hear what you think of that.
I am vaguely looking forward to it. I've heard at least good things about one specific episode with Adrian Brody. Everyone is telling me that episode at least is funny.
Very cool.
Draw your own conclusion.
Okay, very cool. All right, the finale, the season finale of Baskets was just this past week. And I understand that FX has renewed it for a second season.
It has. So even though virtually no one is watching it, it has a place in some people's hearts, even if those people are you and me.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about this on the air that, you know, we looked up the sort of news story to it. They got full cooperation from Arby's. And it added such a wonderful authenticity to it. Because, you know, in most of these kind of shows, it's like it would be like an Arby's kind of like place. But he works at Arby's, and he continually calls the Juggalo guy Arby in the episode as well. But I just thought that was kind of that really added to whatever authenticity that Baskets has. That added a sense of, you know, it fit in the world of Baskets, I thought.
It fit in wonderfully, but remember that they had done the sandwich shop that wasn't a Subway sandwich shop.
That's right.
Two before, involving the different flavored squirt.
That's right.
Which was utterly hilarious. vaguely demented, but also showed how they can do things that aren't necessarily on brand. But no, there was, you know, Baskets was a show that loved its product integration from
Costco
to the vitamin waters that Christine Baskets was drinking. Look, I wonder if the Chemical Brothers had to pay for the endorsement that they bought on a weekly basis on that show. But it did those things and it did them well. And Arby's looked like a great place to work.
It did.
Like if you're having an emotional crisis, Arby's is very good and open to its employees. I felt like it was the only positive publicity.
Yeah, unbelievable. Well, overall, I loved it, man. And I don't know what they're going to do with the second season, considering Chip has become a hobo at the end of the first season. But I don't know. So where do you think it's going to go? And how'd you feel about the season as a whole?
Oh, I thought the season only got better. I thought the season only became more sure of itself. The voice of the show became easier and easier to understand, even when the show was going off on strange fits of fancy to Paris and other odd locations and all of that. I felt like the show got more consistent and almost easier to describe to your friends, or easier to tell your friends that they might like.
Yeah.
And we certainly have done that.
Yes, we have.
Every couple of weeks, we've told the people to watch it. So.
But there's always, every time you come on the show, there's always a basket segment.
Hey, and why not? Because someone's got to talk about it, and so we are. And no, I think that Chip Baskets is a man who has always had an idealized vision of things that other people do not idealize, whether it's being a clown, whether it's Bakersfield, California, etc. So I can imagine that Chip Baskets would have a glamorized, halcyon vision of what it would be like to ride the rails with a hobo.
Yeah.
And guess what? That's not going to be what he's going to discover on America's train system in 2016. So I can see how he might be disappointed.
Yeah, well, I'm on board. Okay, now we mentioned Baskets all the time, and of course we mentioned OJ. Now there are two OJ things to mention. One, have you seen the finale of The People versus O.J. Simpson?
I have not. FX did send out links tonight, last night, whatever Wednesday night is, and I just haven't had the chance to get to it. Several of my colleagues, I know the minute that FX sent out the screener link, they made sure that they watched. I will watch it tomorrow morning.
Okay.
But so far, no one has spoiled it for me on Twitter.
They didn't spoil the ending of the trial? Oh, my God.
So far, they have not. So
well,
don't tell me what happened.
You know my opinion of this show, Dan. I watch it live every week. It doesn't matter to me. It's appointment television for me. And I think it's absolutely great. And I love that Sterling K. Brown got to really have some great moments in the last episode. And they seem to do that with every, and so did Nathan Lane. He had a spectacular scene in South Carolina.
Yes.
Which was just amazing. And everybody in that show gets to shine. It's so good. It's so compelling. I adore The People versus OJ.
There are definitely people I know out there who would be happy to just keep watching, even if after we get the verdict in next week's finale, they would just watch those 5 or 6 years that OJ spent looking for the real killer and mostly going to parties down in Miami Beach. And I think people would be happy to watch that, and I'm sure people would be happy to watch an entire season dedicated to the unfortunate sports memorabilia fiasco in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
But that's not what FX has in mind, and probably that's okay.
Yeah.
I think it's probably okay to let this be something that Ryan Murphy did well start to finish, and as opposed to the old line that Ryan Murphy does things and then eventually they go off the rails and everything goes crazy. If this is something where Ryan Murphy actually puts together 10 episodes of a series and everyone is like, wow, that was 10 cohesive episodes.
Right.
I think that'd be a good thing to put on Ryan Murphy's mantle, probably.
Agreed. Yeah, it's great stuff. All right, and the other one is the O.J. Made in America 30 for 30 show. And this is interesting. It's not going to come out until June, but you've seen it, and it's a 10-hour doc, right?
Uh-huh.
And this is interesting because it's going to debut on ABC and then move over to ESPN for the rest of it?
It is a somewhat odd thing they're doing. They're trying to get a little bit more awareness for it. It will premiere on June 11th on ABC, and then a couple nights later it'll move over to ESPN for the rest of its run. And each night, the episodes will air at 9 o'clock from 9 to 11, but each night the previous week's episode will air from 7 to 9. So if you miss one, you can watch a four-hour block if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw it before it premiered at Sundance, and to me, it's the better 10-hour O.J. story. And so that's saying a lot. It's not going to have nearly as many viewers. It's not going to have nearly as many people having fun with it. I just think it is an amazingly substantive piece of long-form documentary filmmaking from ESPN. It's under the 30 for 30 banner, but it's their first mini-series, I guess, is how they'd want to put it. And it's just really terrific. It's not just the trial. So people who feel like they're burnt out on the trial, it's not that. That's about 4 hours of it or 5 hours of it. But there's, you know, some people may not even know this. O.J. Simpson was a football player.
Oh, that's right.
So that's covered in this documentary. And also, O.J. Simpson was a fine actor. And so,
he was in Capricorn 1, Dan.
Peter Hyams is a talking ape.
Oh, is that right? Head. That's awesome.
Oh, absolutely. It's totally my favorite part of the documentary is that Peter Hyams is candid and frequently on camera talking about O.J. Simpson, the actor, and all of that.
That's great.
It's terrific. No, but it puts everything in context. It continues the story after the verdict. It continues with stuff in Las Vegas. I think it's amazing, and I would at this point virtually guarantee it will be in my top five for the year when all is said and done. And you know, it could end up being that two different 10-hour O.J. Simpson series are in my top 10 at the end of the year, which would be an odd thing for 2016, but that's coming in June, and definitely we can talk about it more as we get up to it, because it's really good as well. And you know, people shouldn't feel as if because they've watched the FX thing they don't have room in their life for the ESPN thing. One definitely complements the other.
Okay.
I think
cool. OJ Made in America debuts on ABC on June 11th, and we'll run that week. The rest of them will run on ESPN, and we'll keep you posted on that. Dan, always a pleasure, my friend.
Anytime, sir.
You got it, and you can read Dan at The Hollywood Reporter and follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you, Dan.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
All right. See you. There you go. Dan Feinberg, everybody, talking TV. Great guy. All right. We'll take a break, and we'll come back with more. We're going to talk about really bad opening pickup lines. That's coming up, and more. Oh, and by the way, we also have some incredible facts about Sanford and Son that we will share with you. So please stick around.